Kis al o yevecha unsana o Adonai Elohecha biyadecha v'shavisa shivyo. When you go out to war against your enemies and God gives them over into your hand and you capture some of them. We'll stop there. There's a lot to be said, and we'll continue in a moment.
OU Israel presents...
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Ki Teitze. Recording and first availability, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the ninth day of Elul, 5777, this year corresponding to August 31st. What's interesting about 31st of any month is that we in the Jewish calendar do not have any 31s. It goes like this. It takes the moon to go through its cycles, a cycle of phases, somewhere between 29 and 30 days. To be specific, it averages 29 and a half days and another 44 minutes and about 3 1/3 seconds. That period in English is called a lunation, and we would call it from one molad to the next, or sometimes actually refer to it as a molad. The cycle of the moon determines our months. And since we don't accept the notion of partial days, our months need to be either 29 days or 30 days. In the time of Sanhedrin, past and future, it was a physical matter of when the moon would be visible next. Between visibility of one of the earliest moon in one month and the next month, there could be a 29-day month or a 30-day month because Sanhedrin was empowered to declare the beginning of the month, Rosh Chodesh, based on eyewitness testimony to the visibility of the first visibility of the lunar crescent. In our fixed calendar without a Sanhedrin, it is not a physical issue, it is a mathematical issue, a calculation issue, and we are commanded, so to speak, or let's say the procedure that we inherited between Sanhedrins is a mathematical one that depends upon the average period of a lunation, the numbers that I told you before. The fact of the matter is that the time between one astronomical new moon and the next varies from that average as many as 10 to 12 hours plus or minus, and sometimes it gets close. And those are calculable, but with much more knowledge necessary in order to calculate them properly. And our calendar is simplified by the use of average. The secular calendar, which follows the cycle of the Earth around the Sun, the year, ends up with 365 1/4, a tiny bit less, number of days per year. That was broken into 12 parts, each one called a month, because it was close to the cycle of the moon, but not close enough. And the result of that was 30-day months, 31-day months, and the case of February 28 or 29. In the Jewish calendar, 29 or 30. In our fixed calendar, there's a certain pattern. And in the time of Sanhedrin, past and future, it is, as I said, based on eyewitness testimony, so no pattern can be discerned. That's the story. Let us continue with Tehillim Kuf Lamed Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kroticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli Tehiena Oznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avono Tishmar Ya Adonai Mi'ya'amod Ki Imecha Hasalicha L'ma'an Tivare. Ki Viti Adonai Kivata Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hochalti. Nafshi L'Adonai Mishomerim L'Boker Shomerim LaBoker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai HaChesed V'Harbe Imo Fedut V'Hu Yifdeh Et Yisrael Mikol Avonotav. Achinu Kol Beit Yisrael Hanatunim Batzara V'Ashivya Ha'omdim Bein Bayam Uvein Bayabasha Hamakom Yirachem Aleihem V'Yotziyem Mitzara Lirvacha U'Meafela La'ora U'Mishibud L'Geula Hashta ba'agala uvisman kariv vinomar. Amen. That put you into the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur mood and mode. Certainly a very moving song, Chamol Al Ma'asecha, a part of the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur davening, where the Chazan, on our behalf, asks God to have mercy on his creations. Okay, let's get down to Parsha Ki Teitzeh, the all-time champ. As far as number of mitzvot is concerned, we have 613 mitzvot in the Torah. 74 of them are counted from Parshat Ki Teitzeh. One feels almost that Moshe is panicking that his demise will come before he has a chance to review the mitzvot and other things he wants to talk to the people. And in the last two Shabbatot, we've read Ray with 55 mitzvot last week, Shofetim with 41, and now 74 from Ki Teitzei. A total for these three sederas of 170 mitzvot, and there's really nothing like it in the rest of the Torah. Or there is, but different. Okay. So mitzvot fly at you from all directions. And what's interesting to note, which is why I chose the opening music, which I've used before, it's the intro to Hogan's Heroes because of the war battles aspect. Interesting that the Parsha of Ki Teitzei begins with war, has war in the middle, and has war at the end. And there are many mitzvot that are attached to it. At the beginning, we find the very, surprising and maybe even a little strange mitzvah category called Yifat Toar, the beautiful captive. Now, let me clarify something. At the end of the parsha, we're going to read about the command to do battle against Amalek. The battle against Amalek, there are no captives. It's to destroy the entire nation. The battle of the seven against the seven nations in Eretz Canaan, also no survivors. And then there's a whole other category called Milchemet Reshut, the optional wars and battles, which are declared by kings for various purposes. And those captives are permitted. Booty, spoils of war is permitted. And this goes by God's command. In other words, whenever there was a battle where we were told you can't touch anything and you can't take anything, then we don't. And if someone did, there were dire consequences. And when we were allowed to take spoils of war, we did. And that's basically the issue. But here, we're dealing with one specific aspect of that kind of Milchemet Reshut, when a soldier basically falls in love, or to be more honest would be to say falls in lust, of a beautiful woman of the enemy which we are fighting. And the Torah, maybe surprisingly, regulates what the person is to do, rather than say, what are you out of your mind? You can't do that. It just doesn't go with the whole Jewish way of life. And the fact is, it really doesn't go with the Jewish way of life. But, as the commentaries seem to say, God was making a concession to the evil inclination of the person, rather than shutting him out completely by saying you can't do this at all. God was reacting, so to speak, although that's not a good term when you're talking about God, to the passion that a person has in time of war. And instead of saying no, or instead of saying do whatever you want, it was regulated with a procedure that involved de-beautifying the captive and having her weep for a month for her lost culture and family. And it's tied in, don't want to get involved too much in this, with her commitment to actively and sincerely practice life as a Jew. And the process of taking this captive includes the equivalent of a conversion process. Once such a woman becomes the man's wife, she is a 100% wife, equal to all other wives, entitled to all stipulations of a ketuvah, and cannot be at all demeaned by saying, I saved your life by falling for you, and therefore don't expect me to treat you like a regular situation. He has to. In fact, the Torah seems to build the procedure of the beautiful captive in such a way that it will not usually end in the consummation of a real legitimate marriage. And if it turns out that the guy comes to his senses, so to speak, and is no longer attracted to the woman, that he lets her free without demeaning her and without enslaving her or anything like that. Again, don't want to go into too many details about it, but it exists. And its existence as a mitzvah or a series of mitzvot is very informative to us. And the idea that God, so to speak, this is the way I would put it, recognizes that we are human beings is very important. God did not create us in his image on the level of God, but created us as human beings with our failings, with our temptations, and that's where everything starts from. So you have that situation of the Yifat Tohar. This is part of why Hogan's Heroes came to my mind, because there were very many episodes that had some beautiful girl, young woman, who not necessarily was a captive, but it went into the Hogan's Hero mix, so to speak, and to me made that music a little bit more appropriate for the Parsha. Now, I mentioned in the middle of the Sedra, we come back to war situations, and we have a portion which begins, not ki teitse la milchama, when you go out to battle, but ki teitse machane al oyevecha, when you set up a military camp. Then there are procedures of physical cleanliness and spiritual and emotional cleanliness. And I just would like to share, probably again, an anecdote from my own experience. And I'm only saying it's ki'ilu, it's like it, it's not really the same kind of setup that the Torah is describing, but it's close. I did the bulk of my reserve duty with a unit that twice a year had what were called targilim, field exercises, on an Ugda level, which means a very large operation. An Ugda, I think, is the equivalent to a company in the American Army. And I was out on the field. Now, I was just telling somebody the other day that as the camp was set up, we're talking about a two-week period of an exercise, a field exercise. So army bulldozers came in and dug trenches, and then another army unit came with these large outhouse type of things and set them up over the trenches for sanitary purposes. And that is right out of the Torah, which commands that to be done. So it was nice to experience firsthand a fulfillment of a mitzvah that is not usually in the purview of the average Jew in the course of his year, in the course of his life. But in an Army of Israel situation, you see it happen in front of your nose. Now, the problem is, speaking of noses, the first day or two of these latrines, they were bearable, and then you needed to find yourself an alternate facility. And that is why I came to my Miluim with a little garden spade, a shovel, which was part of my equipment, which is also the fulfillment of a mitzvah in the Torah, v'yateid tihyeh al ezanecha, a yateid, a digging tool, a spade, shall be part of your equipment. And I was thrilled and delighted to be able to do that mitzvah, or at least the idea of that mitzvah, when I was part of IDF and we had these targilim. What really brought it to a very rewarding level was one evening when I was returning to our tent, a huge tent where operations were taking place, and I needed to stow my garden shovel, having just used it and cleaned it, and put it into its plastic bag. And in order to maneuver it to the bottom of my duffel bag, I needed to remove something from the top, which happened to be my talis and tefillin bag. So I'm crouching down next to my kit bag, and in one hand I have my talis and tefillin, and then in the other hand I have a garden shovel. And I turn to one of my colleagues who happened to be sitting there, not religious, and I said to him in Hebrew, with these, and I referred to my talis and tefillin, I do mitzvot, and I referred to the garden shovel, and I said, with this, I do a mitzvah as well. He said the equivalent of, what are you talking about? So I explained it a little, and since he could read Hebrew better than I can, I handed him a chapter in a sefer that I had with me always in the army called Dinei Tzava Umilchama, the Laws of the Army and War. And I bookmarked the chapter called V'haya Machanecha Kadosh, and your camp shall be holy. And I gave it to him to read. He reads it, he returns the book, and Miluim is over, and we go our separate ways. 6 months later, approximately, we're in Miluim again, a Targil in a different place now, and he pulls me off to the side, and he says, I'd rather you not tell anybody this, but in my place of work, there had always been a shiur in Parshat HaShavua once a week for the religious workers, and I never ever thought it had anything to do with me. But because you showed me that chapter in that sefer, I realized that I have a lot to learn, and I started going to the Parshat HaShavua class. I was thrilled. Miluim is over. 6 months later, we're back in Miluim. Hi, how you doing? How you been? And he pulls me off to the side and says, this you can't tell anybody, but I want you to know that I started to say Kiddush on Friday night, not Chas v'Chalila, not God forbid that I'm becoming religious. No, but I want my children to see Kiddush on Friday night. I get very choked up. I'm telling you this now, more than 25 years later, and I still get choked up. I wish I had more to the story, because both of us ended our service. We were roughly the same age and retired from the army, he having spent a lot more years than I did, because he was an Israeli, and I do remember we had one thing in common in our background. We both were on the fencing team of college, at Yeshiva University, and he at the Technion in Haifa, or something like that. In any event, I don't have more of the story. I don't know. It would be nice to say today he's a Rosh Yeshiva someplace. I don't know what happened to him. The truth is, I would have to think very hard to remember his name. Somehow, that's what happens in the army. But that is the topic of mitzvot in the middle of the parsha related to army situations and war. At the end of the Sedra, we have Zachor, remember what Amalek did when you came out of Egypt, and do battle when you go into Eretz Yisrael and you're settled and you have a king, one of your priorities is to destroy Amalek because of what kind of enemy they are to the Jewish people. Don't want to go into it more than that now, but that's how I wanted to start. And all of that is why Hogan's Heroes was the opening of the show. On the lighter side, I wanted to share with you, if in case you don't know this, that Hogan's Heroes, first of all, there were a lot of Holocaust survivors that did not like the show at all. They found that it was making fun and light of something that had no business being made fun of. On the other hand, I read an interview or series of interviews with some of the actors from Hogan's Heroes. Now, there was the fellow who played the commandant, the head of the prisoner of war camp, and he's Jewish. And in the interview, he said when he was offered the role, his first inclination was to turn it down because of the sensitivity of portraying a Nazi character with a Jewish having a Jewish background. But then he made a stipulation, and when he found that it was going to be followed, he took the part. And that was that in every single episode, the Nazis come out looking like idiots, which was very true in the whole series of Hogan's Heroes. And he felt that that was his actor's way of striking back at the Nazis. Then there was the fellow, another actor, who played Le Beau, the Frenchie. He was a survivor of the Shoah, a Jew, who also felt that his role as a prisoner of war in a German prisoner of war camp would be a sort of revenge, I don't know if that's the right word, against the Nazis. Just train of thought, to my mother-in-law's credit, Aleha Shalom, she was a very, very mild-mannered person, to an extreme. She was a survivor of a number of camps, and she lived into her 80s, more than twice as long, she used to tell me, as the Nazis wanted her to live. She had children, which the Nazis didn't want her to have, obviously, and she had grandchildren, my daughters, who the Nazis tried to prevent. So she felt that every day that she lived was a revenge against the Nazis, and there's something to it. I, having grown up in Brooklyn with Brooklyn-born parents, had a very different perspective on things, but I think I understand the feeling of my mother-in-law as well as those two actors from Hogan's Heroes that I referred to. Last week, most of the show was about a pasuk in Shofetim, which I've been very excited about since a week and a half ago till this day. Last week, I gave a shiur on it. I wrote the lead tidbit in Torah Tidbits on it. I spent most of this show, Torah Tidbits Audio, on it. I spoke it over to several people whose feedback I needed and wanted. And I couldn't get it out of my system. Not that you should want to get something like that out of your system. But I sort of was saddened when Shabbat came and went and Parshat Shofetim was now behind me because I wasn't finished with that pasuk. So I gave a shiur on it this week and wrote a lead tidbit in Torah Tidbits about three times longer than usual. And I sort of said what I wanted to say finally. And I'll just wrap it up here. The idea, first of all, the pasuk is like the grandfather clause of the Torah. It is the verse that obligates us to listen to the oral law as transmitted to us generation after generation, including that which they explain by this tradition is what the Torah means and wants us to do or not to do, and also the legislation of Sanhedrins in the past, who in essence created the body of law which we refer to as Durabanan, rabbinic legislation, and rabbinic psak halacha, halachic rulings. And it's all part of Torah by virtue of the fact that the written Torah contains the command al pi ha-Torah asher yaruha va'al ha-mishpat asher yomaru lecha ta'aseh, ... You will follow what the Torah says to do. And what the judges of Sanhedrins explain to you your obligations. And I used this week's Sedra, which is loaded with mitzvot that serve as examples. So I just want to choose a pair of mitzvot that I think I've spoken about, I know I've spoken about in the past, but put it into that context because I did not use it in previous shiurim or in writings. There's a pair of mitzvot that share one parsha, one passage, paragraph in the Torah. One of them says, Lo tacharosh b'shor uvachamor yachdav. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. The immediately following verse says, Lo tilbash sha'atnez. You shall not wear sha'atnez. Tzemer ufishtim, wool and linen, yachdav. So in these two psukim, we have lo, thou shalt not, lo, a verb, tacharosh or tilbash, to plow or to wear. You have two things, shor v'chabash b'shor v'chamor, with an ox and a donkey. And in the other pasuk, tzemer ufishtim, wool and linen. And the pasuk, each one finishes with the word yachdav. Similar as they are, there is a very significant difference. When you ask the question, can I plow with an ox and a horse? The answer is no, you can't. How about an elephant and a giraffe? No, you can't. What are you telling me? You're telling me that by Torah law or rabbinic law, which is it, that shor includes many other animals, chamor includes many other animals. What if I don't plow with them, but I use them to pull a wagon? Still forbidden. Not only is it forbidden, it's forbidden by Torah law. Lo tacharosh b'shor uvachamor yachdav. You shalt not plow with an ox and a donkey together. Is the verse that forbids a bandwagon to be pulled by an elephant harnessed to two giraffes? Not by rabbinic legislation, but by Torah law that is orally transmitted generation to generation. Therefore, what commands us and gives us the scope of this mitzvah is the pasuk from last week's Sedra of Al Pi HaTorah Asher Yoruha, according to the Torah, which they will command you. And it goes on and on. Now, what about shatnez? Wool and linen. Can I use wool and linen for a wall hanging, a tapestry? The answer is yes. Can I use cotton and linen, or cotton and wool and weave them together and wear a garment like this made from them? The answer is yes. And we are taught very different from ox or any animal, donkey or any animal, plowing or any act. We are taught here wool only, linen only, planting, wearing only. In other words, in the first verse, Lo tacharosh b'shor v'chamor yachtav, shore is lav davka, not just the shore. Chamor, lav davka, not just. Charisha, plowing, lav davka. And the next pasuk is specifically wool, and specifically linen, and specifically wearing, that the Torah forbids. How do you know that? That's part of the oral law. The oral law, as transmitted generation to generation, tells us which terms are inclusive and which terms are exclusive. Yom means day. Inclusive, it would mean a 24-hour period. Exclusive, it would mean daytime and not nighttime. So when Yom appears in a mitzvah, in a pasuk in the Torah, what do you mean by Yom? Depends. And the only way you could know which one means inclusive and which one means exclusive is by oral tradition. And therefore, it's not just oral, because the written word carries the mitzvah al pi ha-Torah asher yorucha v'al ha-mitzvah asher yomerulacha ta'aseh. I really didn't want to overdo that idea, but I have been overdoing it, so let me just make sure it's clear. And I'll tell you why I'm so excited about it, and I don't want to leave it alone. I had always thought, till a couple of weeks ago, that Al Pi HaTorah Asher Yorucha is the pasuk in the Torah that commands us to listen to the dictates of the rabbis in the realm of rabbinic law. That means when they say to observe Chanukah for 8 days, we have to do it. Backed up by the Torah, but it's rabbinic law. When they say wash Netilat Yadayim in the morning or before a meal, or make or light Shabbos candles or Yom Tov candles, or read Megillat Esther, those are all rabbinic law which have the backing of the Torah, because the Torah says Al Pi HaTorah Asher Yorucha. I wasn't actively aware. I don't know if that's really the right way to say it, but I realized, and I checked this out, that verse Al Pi HaTorah Asher Yorucha is much more than giving Torah backing to rabbinic law. It's giving Torah backing to the entire Torah, because presented the physical written Torah, you go page after page, column after column, passage after passage, mitzvah after mitzvah, and in most cases you say, what am I supposed to do? Comes the Torah in writing and tells us what we have to do. It tells us Al Pi HaTorah Asher Yorucha. You do the way that Chazal tell you. Not just rabbinic law, but when they define Torah law, that's what you have to follow. Even if it departs from the plain meaning of the verse. I always use as an example the positioning of the tefillin of the head, which the Torah says, put it bein einecha, between your eyes. But if a person puts his tefillin on the bridge of his nose, he's not fulfilling the mitzvah. Because the Torah, true, says, v'hayulato tefot bein einecha, but then the Torah also says, the equivalent of, if you want to know what that means, then al pi ha-Torah asher yorucha, v'al ha-mishpat asher yomerulecha, ta'aseh. You do it the way the sages have presented it. That's the transmission of oral law. That's the legislation of rabbinic law. That is the package deal as to how to properly observe and live a life of Torah. You cannot say, I read only the Bible. I know the Bible says a person shall not go out of his place on the seventh day, so I don't leave my bedroom, or I don't leave my bed, or I don't leave my house. Because our sages say that's not what it means. That's not what God commanded. God commanded that you stay, quote, at home, that you stay within your city. And if you go outside of your location, defined in all different kind of ways, you have a limit of 2,000 amot, which is approximately a kilometer, in all directions, and further than that you can't go. So when a person observes Tchum Shabbat, the Shabbos boundary, it is partially because of the verse, Al Yetzei Ish Mimekomo Bayom HaShvi'i, and partly because of the verse, Al Pi HaTorah Asher Yorucha, V'al HaMishpat Asher Yomerulecha Ta'aseh, Lo Ta'asur, you shall not veer from what they teach you, neither to the right nor to the left. Again, I tend to get very excited about this because it presents the written word, the oral word, and rabbinic law as a package deal. And as a package deal, that's what our commitment should be. Our religion is not supposed to be pick what you like, leave what you don't like. Because there are groups, past and present, who have made Judaism into that. They will say, oh, this area of law, that's archaic, we don't need it anymore. Oh, and this, no, that's a little violent, we're not going to do that. And that, oh yeah, that's nice, we'll take that. That's not Judaism. There's a lot more, but I need to leave it at that. And we'll put on one more mood music for Yamim Noraim approaching. Let me just tie it together in the following way. If you want to know the best way to approach Yom Hadin, Judgment Day, is through the process of tshuva, repentance. And what that means is a higher adherence to mitzvot. And that includes everything. It includes the mitzvot between man and God and between a person and his fellow. And it means manners, and it means niceness and courtesy, and it means charitable behavior. It means acts of kindness. That's all part of mitzvah. So with the proliferation of mitzvot in Re'eh and Shofetim and this week in Ki Teitzei, but also very important, the upcoming weeks that lead us into Rosh Hashanah will have the fundamental concepts of reward and punishment and accountability and free will, and that puts a whole perspective on mitzvot. So you need that as a package, and Moshe Rabbeinu provides us that in the book of Devarim. On that note, I will say Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.
Посылай дивтов у фигияки. Yagin, the hilo.